Chapter 5. Now, where have I seen her before? One of the great things about being a professor of English is that you get to keep meeting old friends. For beginning readers, though, every story may seem new, and the resulting experience of reading is highly disjointed. Think of reading, on one level, as one of those papers from elementary school where you connect the dots. I could never see the picture in a connect-the-dot drawing until I'd put in virtually every line. Other kids could look at a page full of dots and say, "Oh, that's an elephant. That's a locomotive." Me? I saw dots. I think it's partly predisposition. Some people handle two-dimensional visualization better than others, but largely a matter of practice. The more connect-the-dot drawings you do, the more likely you are to recognize the design early on. Same with literature. Part of pattern recognition is talent, but a whole lot of it is practice. If you read enough and give what you read enough thought, you begin to see patterns, archetypes, recurrences. And as with those pictures among the dots, it's a matter of learning to look. Not just to look, but where to look and how to look. Literature, as the great Canadian critic Northrop Frye observed, grows out of other literature. We should not be surprised to find, then, that it also looks like other literature. As you read, it may pay to remember this. There's no such thing as a wholly original work of literature. Once you know that, you can go looking for old friends and asking the attendant question, "Now where have I seen her before?" One of my favorite novels is Tim O'Brien's Going After Cacciato, 1978. Lay readers and students generally like it too, which explains why it has become a perennial strong seller. Although the violence of the Vietnam War scenes may turn some readers off, many find themselves totally engrossed by something they initially figured would just be gross. What readers sometimes don't notice in their involvement with the story, and it is a great story, is that virtually everything in there is cribbed from somewhere else. Lest you conclude with dismay that the novel is somehow plagiarized or less than original, let me add that I find the book wildly original, that everything O'Brien borrows makes perfect sense in the context of the story he's telling, even more so once we understand that he has repurposed materials from older sources to accomplish his own ends. The novel divides into three interwoven parts. One, the actual story of the war experience of the main character, Paul Berlin, up to the point where his fellow soldier, Cacciato, runs away from the war. Two, the imagined trip on which the squad follows Cacciato to Paris. And three, the long night watch on a tower near the South China Sea, where Berlin manages these two very impressive mental feats of memory on the one hand, and invention on the other. The actual war, because it really happened, he can't do much about. Oh, he gets some facts wrong and some events out of order, but mostly, reality has imposed a certain structure on memory. The trip to Paris, though, is another story. Actually, it's all stories. Or all those Paul has read in his young lifetime. He creates events and people out of the novels, stories, histories he knows, his own included, all of which is quite unwitting on his part. The pieces just appearing out of his memory. O'Brien provides us with a wonderful glimpse into the creative process, a view of how stories get written, and a big part of that process is that you can't create stories in a vacuum. Instead, the mind flashes bits and pieces of childhood experiences, past reading, every movie the writer/creator has ever seen, last week's argument with a phone solicitor. In short, everything that lurks in the recesses of the mind. Some of this may be unconscious, as it is in the case of O'Brien's protagonist. Generally, though, writers use prior texts quite consciously and purposefully, as O'Brien himself does. Unlike Paul Berlin, he is aware that he's drawing from Lewis Carroll or Ernest Hemingway. O'Brien signals the difference between novelist and character in the structuring of the two narrative frames. About halfway through the novel, O'Brien has his characters fall through a hole in the road. Not only that, one of the characters subsequently says that the way to get out is to fall back up. When it's stated this baldly, you automatically think of Lewis Carroll. Falling through a hole is like Alice in Wonderland, 1865. Bingo. It's all we need. And the world the squad discovers below the road, the network of Viet Cong tunnels, although nothing like the real ones, complete with an officer condemned to stay there for his crimes, is every bit as much an alternative world as the one Alice encounters in her adventure. Once you've established that a book, a man's book at that, a war book, is borrowing a situation from Lewis Carroll's Alice books, anything is possible. So, with that in mind, readers must reconsider characters, situations, events in the novel. This one looks like it's from Hemingway. That one like Hansel and Gretel. These two from things that happened during Paul Berlin's real war, and so on down the line. Once you've played around with these elements for a while, a kind of trivial pursuit of source material, go for the big one. What about Sarkin Ong Wan? Sarkin Ong Wan is Paul Berlin's love interest, his fantasy girl. She is Vietnamese and knows about tunnels, but is not Viet Cong. She's old enough to be attractive, yet not old enough to make sexual demands on the virginal young soldier. She's not a real character, since she comes in after the start of Berlin's fantasy. Careful readers will find her real model in a young girl with the same hoop earrings when the soldiers frisk villagers in one remembered war scene. Fair enough, but that's just the physical person, not her character. Then who is she? Where does she come from? Think generically. Lose the personal details. Consider her as a type, and try to think where you've seen that type before. A brown-skinned young woman guiding a group of white men, mostly white anyway, speaking the language they don't know, knowing where to go, where to find food, taking them west. Right. No, not Pocahontas. She never led anyone anywhere, whatever the popular culture may suggest. Somehow, Pocahontas has received better PR, but we want the other one. Sacagawea. If I need to be guided across hostile territory, she's the one I want. And she's the one Paul Berlin wants, too. He needs a figure who will be sympathetic, understanding, strong in the ways he's not, and most of all, successful in bringing him safely to his goal of getting to Paris. O'Brien plays here with a reader's established knowledge of history, culture, and literature. He's hoping that your mind will associate Sarkin Ong Wan consciously or unconsciously with Sacagawea, thereby not only creating her personality and impact, but also establishing the nature and depth of Paul Berlin's need. If you require a Sacagawea, you're really lost. The point isn't really which native woman figures in O'Brien's novel. It's that there is a literary or historical model that found her way into his fiction to give it shape and purpose. He could have used Tolkien rather than Carroll, and while the surface features would have been different, the principle would have remained the same. Although the story would go in different directions with a change of literary model, in either case, it gains a kind of resonance from these different levels of narrative that begin to emerge. The story is no longer all on the surface, but begins to have depth. What we're trying to do is learn to read this sort of thing like a wily old professor, to learn to spot those familiar images, like being able to see the elephant before we connect the dots. You say stories grow out of other stories, but Sacagawea was real. As a matter of fact, she was, but from our point of view, it doesn't really matter. History is story too. You don't encounter her directly. You've only heard of her through narrative of one sort or another. She is a literary as well as a historical character, as much a piece of the American myth as Huck Finn or Jay Gatsby, and very nearly as unreal. And what all this is about, finally, is myth. Which brings us to the big secret. Here it is. There's only one story. There. I said it, and I can't very well take it back. There is only one story. Ever. One. It's always been going on, and it's everywhere around us, and every story you've ever read or heard or watched is part of it. The Thousand and One Nights. Beloved. Jack and the Beanstalk. The Epic of Gilgamesh. The Story of O. The Simpsons. T.S. Eliot said that when a new work is created, it is set among the monuments, adding to and altering the order. That always sounds to me a bit too much like a graveyard. To me, literature is something much more alive. More like a barrel of eels. When a writer creates a new eel, it wriggles its way into the barrel, muscles a path into the great teeming mass from which it came in the first place. It's a new eel, but it shares its eelness with all those other eels that are in the barrel or have ever been in the barrel. Now, if that simile doesn't put you off reading entirely, you know you're serious. But the point is this. Stories grow out of other stories. Poems out of other poems. And they don't have to stick to genre. Poems can learn from plays, songs, from novels. Sometimes, influence is direct and obvious. As when the 20th century American writer T. Corrugeson Boyle writes The Overcoat 2, a postmodern reworking of the 19th century Russian writer Nikolai Gogol's classic story, The Overcoat. Or when William Trevor updates James Joyce's Two Gallants with Two More Gallants. Or when John Gardner reworks the medieval Beowulf into his little postmodern masterpiece, Grendel. Other times, it's less direct and more subtle. It may be vague, the shape of a novel generally reminding readers of some earlier novel, or a modern-day miser recalling Scrooge. And, of course, there's the Bible. Among its many other functions, it, too, is part of the one big story. A female character may remind us of Scarlett O'Hara, or Ophelia, or even, say, Pocahontas. These similarities, and they may be straight or ironic or comic or tragic, begin to reveal themselves to readers after much practice of reading. All this resembling other literature is all well and good, but what does it mean for our reading? Excellent question. If we don't see the reference, it means nothing, right? So the worst thing that occurs is that we're still reading the same story as if the literary precursors weren't there. From there, anything that happens is a bonus. A small part of what transpires is what I call the aha factor, the delight we feel at recognizing a familiar component from earlier experience. That moment of pleasure, wonderful as it is not enough. So that awareness of similarity leads us forward. What typically takes place is that we recognize elements from some prior text and begin drawing comparisons and parallels that may be fantastic, parodic, tragic, anything. Once that happens, our reading of the text changes from the reading governed by what's overtly on the page. Let's go back to Cacciato for a moment. When the squad falls through the hole in the road in language that recalls Alice in Wonderland, we quite reasonably expect that the place they fall into will be a wonderland in its own way. Indeed, right from the beginning, this is true. The ox cart and Sarkin Ongwan's aunties fall faster than she and the soldiers, despite the law of gravity, which decrees that falling bodies all move at 32 feet per second squared. The episode allows Paul Berlin to see a Viet Cong tunnel, which his inherent terror will never allow him to do in real life, and this fantastic tunnel proves both more elaborate and more harrowing than the real ones. The enemy officer who is condemned to spend the remainder of the war down there accepts his sentence with a weird illogic that would do Lewis Carroll proud. The tunnel even has a periscope through which Berlin can look back at a scene from the real war, his past. Obviously, the episode could have these features without invoking Carroll, but the Wonderland analogy enriches our understanding of what Berlin has created, furthering our sense of the outlandishness of this portion of his fantasy. This dialogue between old texts and new is always going on at one level or another. Critics speak of this dialogue as intertextuality, the ongoing interaction between poems or stories. This intertextual dialogue deepens and enriches the reading experience, bringing multiple layers of meaning to the text, some of which readers may not even consciously notice. The more we become aware of the possibility that our text is speaking to other texts, the more similarities and correspondences we begin to notice, and the more alive the text becomes. We'll come back to this discussion later, but for now, we'll simply note that newer works are having a dialogue with older ones, and they often indicate the presence of this conversation by invoking the older texts with anything from oblique references to extensive quotations. Once writers know that we know how this game is played, the rules can get very tricky. The late Angela Carter, in her novel Wise Children, 1992, gives us a theatrical family whose fame rests on Shakespearean performance. We more or less expect the appearance of elements from Shakespeare's plays, so we're not surprised when a jilted young woman, Tiffany, walks onto a television show set, distraught, muttering, bedraggled, in a word, mad, and then disappears shortly after departing, evidently having drowned. Her performance is every bit as heartbreaking as that of Ophelia, Prince Hamlet's love interest who goes mad and drowns in the most famous play in English. Carter's novel is about magic, as well as Shakespeare, though, and the apparent drowning is a classic bit of misdirection. The apparently dead Tiffany shows up later, to the discomfort of her faithless lover. Shrewdly, Carter counts on our registering Tiffany equals Ophelia, so that she can use her instead as a different Shakespearean character, Hero, who, in Much Ado About Nothing, allows her friends to stage her death and funeral in order to teach her fiancé a lesson. Carter employs not only materials from earlier texts, but also her knowledge of our responses to them in order to double-cross us, to set us up for a certain kind of thinking so that she can play a larger trick in the narrative. No knowledge of Shakespeare is required to believe Tiffany has died or to be astonished at her return, but the more we know of his plays, the more solidly our responses are locked in. Carter's sleight of narrative challenges our expectations and keeps us on our feet, but it also takes what could seem merely a tawdry incident and reminds us, through its Shakespearean parallels, that there is nothing new in young men mistreating the women who love them, and that those without power in relationships have always had to be creative in finding ways to exert some control of their own. Her new novel is telling a very old story, which in turn is part of the one big story. But what do we do if we don't see all these correspondences? First of all, don't worry. If a story is no good, being based on Hamlet won't save it. The characters have to work as characters as themselves. Sarkin Ong Wan needs to be a great character, which she is, before we need to worry about her resemblance to a famous character of our acquaintance. If the story is good and the characters work, but you don't catch allusions and references and parallels, then you've done nothing worse than read a good story with memorable characters. If you begin to pick up on some of these other elements, these parallels and analogies, however, you'll find your understanding of the novel deepens and becomes more meaningful, more complex. But we haven't read everything. Neither have I, nor has anyone, not even Harold Bloom. Beginning readers, of course, are at a slight disadvantage, which is why professors are useful in providing a broader context. But you definitely can get there on your own. When I was a kid, I used to go mushroom hunting with my father. I would never see them, but he'd say, "There's a yellow sponge," or "There are a couple of black spikes." And because I knew they were there, my looking would become more focused and less vague. In a few moments, I would begin seeing them myself. Not all of them, but some. And once you begin seeing morals, you can't stop. What a literature professor does is very similar. He tells you when you get near mushrooms. Once you know that, though, and you generally are near them, you can hunt for mushrooms on your own. Chapter 6. When in doubt, it's from Shakespeare. Quick quiz. What do John Cleese, Cole Porter, Moonlighting, and Death Valley Days have in common? No, they're not part of some communist plot. All were involved with some version of The Taming of the Shrew by that former glover's apprentice from Stratford-upon-Avon, William Shakespeare. Cleese played Petruchio in the BBC production of the Complete Shakespeare plays in the 1970s. Porter wrote the score for Kiss Me, Kate, the modern musical comedy version on Broadway and on film. The Moonlighting episode called Atomic Shakespeare was one of the funniest and most inventive on a show that was consistently funny and inventive. It was comparatively faithful to the spirit of the original while capturing the essence of the show's regular characters. The truly odd duck here is Death Valley Days, which was an anthology show from the 1950s and 1960s, sometimes hosted by a future president, Ronald Reagan, and sponsored by 20 Mule Team Borax. Their retelling was set in the Old West and completely free of Elizabethan English. For a lot of us, that particular show was either our first encounter with the Bard or our first intimation that he could actually be fun, since in public school, you may recall, they only teach his tragedies. These examples represent only the tip of the iceberg for the perennially abused shrew. Its plot seems to be permanently available to be moved in time and space, adapted, altered, updated, set to music, reimagined in myriad ways. If you look at any literary period between the 18th and 21st centuries, you'll be amazed by the dominance of the Bard. He's everywhere, in every literary form you can think of, and he's never the same. Every age and every writer reinvents its own Shakespeare. All this from a man who we're still not sure actually wrote the plays that bear his name. Try this. In 1982, Paul Mazursky directed an interesting modern version of The Tempest. It had an Ariel figure, Susan Sarandon, a comic but monstrous Caliban, Raoul Julia, and a Prospero, famed director John Cassavetes, an island and magic of a sort. The film's title? Tempest. Woody Allen reworked A Midsummer Night's Dream as his film A Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy. Natch. The BBC series Masterpiece Theatre has recast Othello as a contemporary story of black police commissioner John Othello, his lovely white wife Desi, and his friend Ben Jago, deeply resentful at being passed over for promotion. The action will surprise no one familiar with the original. Add that production to a 19th century opera of some note based on the play. West Side Story famously reworks Romeo and Juliet, which resurfaces again in the 1990s in a movie featuring contemporary teen culture and automatic pistols. And that's a century or so after Tchaikovsky's ballet based on the same play. Hamlet comes out as a new film every couple of years, it seems. Tom Stoppard considers the role and fate of minor characters from Hamlet in his play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And that bastion of high culture, Gilligan's Island, had an episode where Phil Silvers, famous as TV's Sergeant Bilko and therefore adding to the highbrow content, was putting together a musical Hamlet, the highlight of which was Polonius's Neither a Borrower Nor a Lender Be speech, set to the tune of Habanera from Bizet's Carmen. Now that's art. Nor is the Shakespeare adaptation phenomenon restricted to the stage and screen. Jane Smiley rethinks King Lear in her novel A Thousand Acres, 1991. Different time, different place, same meditation upon greed, gratitude, miscalculation, and love. Titles? William Faulkner liked The Sound and the Fury. Aldous Huxley decided on Brave New World. Agatha Christie chose By the Pricking of My Thumbs, which statement Ray Bradbury completed with Something Wicked This Way Comes. The all-time champion for Shakespeare references, though, must be Angela Carter's final novel, Wise Children. The children of the title are twins, illegitimate daughters of the most famous Shakespearean actor of his age, who is the son of the most famous Shakespearean of his age. While the twins, Dora and Nora Chance, are song and dance artists, as opposed to practitioners of legitimate theater, the story Dora tells is full to overflowing with Shakespearean passions and situations. Her grandfather kills his unfaithful wife and himself in a manner strongly reminiscent of Othello. As we saw in the previous chapter, a woman seems to drown like Ophelia, only to turn up in a hugely surprising way very late in the book, like Hero in Much Ado About Nothing. The novel is full of astonishing disappearances and reappearances, characters in disguise, women dressed as men, and the two most spiteful daughters since Reagan and Goneril brought ruin to Lear and his kingdom. Carter envisions a film production of A Midsummer Night's Dream more disastrously hilarious than anything the rude mechanicals of the original could conceive of, the results recalling the real-life all-male film version from the 1930s. Those are just a few of the uses to which Shakespeare's plots and situations get put, but if that's all he amounted to, he'd only be a little different from any other immortal writer. But that's not all. You know what's great about reading old Will? You keep stumbling across lines you've been hearing and reading all your life. Try these. To thine own self be true. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. What a rogue and peasant slave am I. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. Get thee to a nunnery. Who steals my purse steals trash. Life's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The better part of valor is discretion. Exit, pursued by a bear. A horse, my kingdom for a horse. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. O brave new world that has such people in it. Oh, and lest I forget, to be or not to be, that is the question. Ever heard any of those? This week? Today? I heard one of them in a news broadcast the morning I started composing this chapter. In my copy of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, Shakespeare takes up 47 pages. I will admit that not every one of the citations is all that familiar, but enough of them are. In fact, the hardest part of compiling my list of quotations was stopping. I could have gone on all day expanding the list without getting into anything too obscure. My first guess is that you probably have not read most of the plays from which these quotations are taken. My second guess is that you know the phrases anyway, not where they're from necessarily, but the quotes themselves, or the popular versions of them. All right, so the bard is always with us. What does it mean? He means something to us as readers in part because he means so much to our writers. So let's consider why writers turn to our man.
It makes them sound smarter?
Smarter than what?
Than quoting Rocky and Bullwinkle, for instance.
Careful, I'm a big fan of Moose and Squirrel. Still, I take your point. There are lots of sources that don't sound as good as Shakespeare. Almost all of them, in fact.
Plus, it indicates that you've read them, right?
You've come across this wonderful phrase in the course of your reading, so clearly you're an educated person. Not inevitably. I could have given you Richard III's famous request for a horse from the time I was 9. My father was a great fan of that play and loved to recount the desperation of that scene, so I began hearing it in the early grades. He was a factory worker with a high school education and not particularly interested in impressing anybody with his fancy learning. He was pleased, however, to be able to talk about these great stories, these plays he had read and loved. I think that's a big part of the motivation. We love the plays, the great characters, the fabulous speeches, the witty repartee, even in times of duress. I hope never to be mortally stabbed, but if I am, I'd sure like to have the self-possession when asked if it's bad to answer, "No, 'tis not so deep as a well, nor so wide as a church door, but 'tis enough, 'twill serve," as Mercutio does in Romeo and Juliet. I mean, to be dying and clever at the same time? How can you not love that? Rather than saying it proves you're well-read, I think what happens is that writers quote what they've read or heard, and more of them have Shakespeare stuck in their heads than anything else. Except Bugs Bunny, of course.
And it gives what you're saying a kind of authority.
As a sacred text confers authority, or as something exquisitely said confers authority, yes. There is definitely a sacred text quality at work here. When pioneer families went west in their prairie schooners, space was at a premium, so they generally carried only two books, the Bible and Shakespeare. Name another writer to whom high schoolers are subjected in each of 4 years.
If you live in a medium-sized theater market, there is precisely one writer you can count on being in production somewhere in your area every year, and it is neither August Wilson nor Aristophanes. So there is a ubiquity to Shakespeare's work that makes it rather like a sacred text. At some very deep level, he is ingrained in our psyches. But he's there because of the beauty of those lines, those scenes, and those plays. There is a kind of authority lent by something being almost universally known, where one has only to utter certain lines and people nod their heads in recognition. But here's something you might not have thought of. Shakespeare also provides a figure against whom writers can struggle, a source of texts against which other texts can bounce ideas. Writers find themselves engaged in a relationship with older writers. Of course, that relationship plays itself out through the texts, the new one emerging in part through earlier texts that exert influence on the writer in one way or another. This relationship contains considerable potential for struggle, which, as we mentioned in the previous chapter, is called intertextuality. Naturally, none of this is exclusive to Shakespeare, who just happens to be such a towering figure that a great many writers find themselves influenced by him. On intertextuality, more later. For now, an example. T.S. Eliot, in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, 1917, has his neurotic, timorous main character say he was never cut out to be Prince Hamlet, that the most he could be is an extra, someone who could come on to fill out the numbers on stage or possibly be sacrificed to plot exigency. By invoking not a generic figure, I am just not cut out to be a tragic hero, for instance, but the most famous tragic hero, Hamlet, Eliot provides an instantly recognizable situation for his protagonist and adds an element of characterization that says more about his self-image than would a whole page of description. The most poor Prufrock could aspire to would be Bernardo and Marcellus, the guards who first see the ghost of Hamlet's father. Or possibly Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the hapless courtiers used by both sides and ultimately sent unknowing to their own executions. Eliot's poem does more, though, than merely draw from Hamlet. It also opens up a conversation with its famous predecessor. This is not an age of tragic grandeur, Prufrock suggests, but an age of hapless ditherers. Yes, but we recall that Hamlet is himself a hapless ditherer, and it's only circumstance that saves him from his own haplessness and confers on him something noble and tragic. This brief interplay between texts happens in only a couple of lines of verse, yet it illuminates both Eliot's poem and Shakespeare's play in ways that may surprise us just a little, and that never would have been called into existence had Eliot not caused Prufrock to invoke Hamlet as a way of addressing his own inadequacy. It's worth remembering that comparatively few writers slavishly copy bits of Shakespeare's work into their own. More commonly, there is this kind of dialogue going on in which the new work, while taking bits from the older, is also having its say. The author may be reworking a message, exploring changes or continuities in attitudes from one era to another, recalling parts of an earlier work to highlight features of the newly created one, drawing on associations the reader holds in order to fashion something new and, ironically, original. Irony features fairly prominently in the use not only of Shakespeare, but of any prior writer. The new writer has his own agenda, her own slant to put on things. Try this for slant. One of the powerful voices to come out of resistance to apartheid in South Africa is Athol Fugard, best known for his play Master Harold and the Boys, 1982. In creating this play, Fugard turns to you-know-who. Your first instinct might be that he would grasp one of the tragedies, Othello, say, where race is already at issue. Instead, he turns to the history plays, to Henry IV Part II, to the story of a young man who must grow up. In Shakespeare, Prince Hal must put his hard-partying ways behind him, stop his carousing with Falstaff, and become Henry, the king who in Henry V is capable of leading an army and inspiring the kind of passion that will allow the English to be victorious at Agincourt. He must learn, in other words, to wear the mantle of adult responsibility. In Fugard's contemporary reworking, Henry is Harold, Hallie to the black pals with whom he loafs and plays. Like his famous predecessor, Hallie must grow up and become Master Harold, worthy successor to his father in the family business. What does it mean, though, to become a worthy successor in an unworthy enterprise? That is Fugard's question. Harold's mantle is made not only of adult responsibility, but of racism and heartless disregard, and he learns to wear it well. As we might expect, Henry IV Part II provides a means of measuring Harold's growth, which is actually a sort of regression into the most repugnant of human impulses. At the same time, though, Master Harold makes us re-examine the assumptions of right and rights that we take for granted in watching the Shakespearean original. Notions of privilege and noblesse oblige, assumptions about power and inheritance, ideas of accepted behavior, and even of adulthood itself. Is it a mark of growing up that one becomes capable, as Harold does, of spitting in the face of a friend? I think not. Fugard reminds us, of course, even if he does not mention it directly, that the grown-up King Henry must, in Henry V, have his old friend Falstaff hanged. Do the values endorsed by Shakespeare lead directly to the horrors of apartheid? For Fugard, they do, and his play leads us back to a reconsideration of those values and the play that contains them. That's what writers can do with Shakespeare. Of course, they can do it with other writers as well, and they do, if somewhat less frequently. Why? You know why. The stories are great, the characters compelling, the language fabulous. And we know him. You can allude to Fulke Greville, but you'd have to provide your own footnotes. So, what's in it for readers? As the Fugard example suggests, when we recognize the interplay between these dramas, we become partners with a new dramatist in creating meaning. Fugard relies on our awareness of the Shakespearean text as he constructs his play, and that reliance allows him to say more with fewer direct statements. I often tell my students that reading is an activity of the imagination, and the imagination in question is not the writer's alone. Moreover, our understanding of both works becomes richer and deeper as we hear this dialogue playing out. We see the implications for the new work, while at the same time, we reconfigure our thinking, if only slightly, about the earlier one. And the writer we know better than any other, the one whose language and whose plays we know, even if we haven't read him, is Shakespeare. So if you're reading a work and something sounds too good to be true, you know where it's from. The rest, dear friends, is silence. Chapter 7, Or the Bible. Connect these dots. Garden, serpent, plagues, flood, parting of waters, loaves, fishes, 40 days, betrayal, denial, slavery and escape, fatted calves, milk and honey. Ever read a book with all these things in them? Guess what? So have your writers, poets, playwrights, screenwriters. Samuel L. Jackson's character in Pulp Fiction, in between all the swear words, or that one swear word all those times, is a Vesuvius of biblical language, one steady burst of apocalyptic rhetoric and imagery. His linguistic behavior suggests that at some time, Quentin Tarantino, the writer-director, was in contact with the good book, despite all his bad language. Why is that James Dean film called East of Eden? Because the author of the novel on which the film is based, John Steinbeck, knew his book of Genesis. To be East of Eden, as we shall see, is to be in a fallen world, which is the only kind we know, and certainly the only kind there could be in a James Dean film. The devil, as the old saying goes, can quote scripture. So can writers. Even those who aren't religious or don't live within the Judeo-Christian tradition may work something in from Job or Matthew or the Psalms. That may explain all those gardens, serpents, tongues of flame, and voices from whirlwinds. In Toni Morrison's Beloved, 1987, four white men ride up to the house in Ohio where the escaped slave Sethi has been living with her small children. In a fit of determination to save her children from slavery, she tries to kill them, succeeding only with her two-year-old daughter, known later as Beloved. No one, neither ex-slave nor free white, can believe or understand her action, and that incomprehension saves her life and rescues her remaining children from slavery. Does her violent frenzy make sense? No. It's irrational, excessive, disproportionate. They all agree on that. On the other hand, there's something about it that, to us, makes sense. The characters all see four white men from slave country riding up the road. We see, and Sethi intuits, that what's coming in the front gate is the apocalypse. When the four horsemen come, it's the last day, the time for judgment. Morrison's color scheme isn't quite that of St. John's original. It's hard to come up with a green horse. But we know them, not least because she actually calls them the Four Horsemen. Not riders, not men on horses, not equestrians. Horsemen. That's pretty unambiguous. Moreover, one of them stays mounted with a rifle slung across his lap. That looks a lot like the Fourth Horseman, the one who in Revelation rides the pale or green horse, and whose name is Death. In Pale Rider, Clint Eastwood actually has a character speak the relevant passage, so we don't miss the point. Although the unnamed stranger in an Eastwood Western is pretty much always Death. But here, Morrison does the same with a three-word phrase and a pose. Unmistakable. So when the apocalypse comes riding up your lane, what will you do? And that is why Sethi reacts as she does. Morrison is American, of course, and raised in the Protestant tradition, but the Bible is non-sectarian. James Joyce, an Irish Catholic, uses biblical parallels with considerable frequency. I often teach his story, Araby, 1914, a lovely little gem about the loss of innocence. Another way of saying loss of innocence, of course, is the fall. Adam and Eve, the garden, the serpent, the forbidden fruit. Every story about the loss of innocence is really about someone's private reenactment of the fall from grace, since we experience it not collectively, but individually and subjectively. Here's the setup. A young boy, 11, 12, 13 years old, right in there, who has previously experienced life as safe, uncomplicated, and limited to attending school and playing cowboys and Indians in the Dublin streets with his friends, discovers girls. Or, specifically, one girl, his friend Mangan's sister. Neither the sister nor our young hero has a name, so his situation is made slightly generic, which is useful. Being in early adolescence, the narrator has no way of dealing with the object of his desire, or even the wherewithal to recognize what he feels as desire. After all, his culture does all it can to keep boys and girls separate and pure, and his reading has described relations between the sexes in only the most general and chaste of terms. He promises to try to buy her something from a bazaar, the Araby of the title, to which she can't go, significantly because of a religious retreat being put on by her convent school. After many delays and frustrations, he finally arrives at the bazaar just as it's closing. Most of the stalls are closed, but he finally finds one, where a young woman and two young men are flirting in ways that are not very appealing to our young swain, and she can scarcely be bothered to ask what he wants. Daunted, he says he wants nothing, then turns away, his eyes blinded by tears of frustration and humiliation. He suddenly sees that his feelings are no loftier than theirs, that he's been a fool, that he's been running this errand on behalf of an ordinary girl who's probably never given him a single thought. Wait a minute. Innocence, maybe, but the fall? Sure. Innocence, then it's loss. What more do you need? Something biblical. A serpent. An apple. At least a garden. Sorry, no garden, no apple. The bazaar takes place inside. But there are two great jars standing by the booth, Joyce says, like Eastern guards. And those guards are as biblical as it gets. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. That would be Genesis 3:24 for those of you keeping score. As we all know, there's nothing like a flaming sword to separate you from something, and in this case, that something is a former innocence, whether of Eden or of childhood. The thing about loss of innocence stories, the reason they hit so hard, is that they're so final. You can never go back. That's why the boy's eyes sting with blinding tears. It's that flaming sword. Maybe a writer doesn't want enriching motifs, characters, themes, or plots, but just needs a title. The Bible is full of possible titles. I mentioned East of Eden before. Tim Parks has a novel called Tongues of Flame. Faulkner has Absalom, Absalom, and Go Down Moses. Okay, that last one's from a spiritual, but it's biblical in its basis. Let's suppose you want to write a novel about hopelessness and infertility, and the sense that the future no longer exists. You might turn to Ecclesiastes for a passage that reminds us that every night is followed by a new day, that life is an endless cycle of life, death, and renewal, in which one generation succeeds another until the end of time. You might regard that outlook with a certain irony and borrow a phrase from it to express that irony. How the certainty that the earth and humanity will renew themselves, a certainty that has governed human assumptions since earliest times, has just been shredded by 4 years in which Western civilization tried with some success to destroy itself. You just might if you were a modernist and had lived through the horror that was the Great War. At least that's what Hemingway did, borrowing his title from that biblical passage, The Sun Also Rises. Great book, perfect title. More common than titles are situations and quotations. Poetry is absolutely full of scripture. Some of that is perfectly obvious. John Milton took most of his subject matter and a great deal of material for his great works from you know where. Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, Samson Agonistes. Moreover, our early literature in English is frequently about and nearly always informed by religion. Those questing knights in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and the Fairy Queen are searching on behalf of their religion, whether they know it or not, and they generally do know. Beowulf is largely about the coming of Christianity into the old paganism of northern Germanic society, after being about a hero overcoming a villain. Grendel, the monster, is descended from the line of Cain, we're told. Aren't all villains? Even Chaucer's pilgrims in the Canterbury Tales, 1384, while neither they nor their tales are inevitably holy, are making an Easter pilgrimage to Canterbury Cathedral, and much of their talk invokes the Bible and religious teaching. John Donne was an Anglican minister, Jonathan Swift, the Dean of the Church of Ireland, Edward Taylor and Anne Bradstreet, American Puritans, Taylor a minister. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a Unitarian minister for a spell, while Gerard Manley Hopkins was a Catholic priest. One can barely read Donne or Mallory or Hawthorne or Rossetti without running into quotations, plots, characters, whole stories drawn from the Bible. Suffice it to say that every writer prior to sometime in the middle of the 20th century was solidly instructed in religion. Even today, a great many writers have more than a nodding acquaintance with the faith of their ancestors. In the century just ended, there are modern religious and spiritual poets like T.S. Eliot and Jeffrey Hill or Adrian Rich and Allen Ginsberg whose work is shot through with biblical language and imagery. The Dive Bomber in Eliot's Four Quartets, 1942, looks very like a dove offering salvation from the bomber's fire through the redemption of Pentecostal fires. He borrows the figure of Christ joining the disciples on the road to Emmaus in the Wasteland, 1922, uses the Christmas story in Journey of the Magi, 1927, offers a fairly idiosyncratic sort of Lenten consciousness in Ash Wednesday, 1930. Hill has wrestled with matters of the spirit in the fallen modern world throughout his career, so it is hardly surprising to find biblical themes and images in works such as The Pentecost Castle or Canaan, 1996. Rich, for her part, addresses the earlier poet Robinson Jeffers in Yom Kippur, 1984, in which she considers the implications of the Day of Atonement, and matters of Judaism appear in her poetry with some frequency. Ginsberg, who never met a religion he didn't like, he sometimes described himself as a Buddhist Jew, employs material from Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and virtually every world faith. Not all uses of religion are straight, of course. Many modern and postmodern texts are essentially ironic, in which the allusions to biblical sources are used not to heighten continuities between the religious tradition and the contemporary moment, but to illustrate a disparity or disruption. Needless to say, such uses of irony can cause trouble. When Salman Rushdie wrote The Satanic Verses, 1988, he caused his characters to parody, in order to show their wickedness, among other things, certain events and persons from the Quran and the life of the Prophet. He knew not everyone would understand his ironic version of a holy text. What he could not imagine was that he could be so far misunderstood as to induce a fatwa, a sentence of death, to be issued against him. In modern literature, many Christ figures, which I will discuss in more detail in Chapter 14, are somewhat less than Christ-like, a disparity that does not inevitably go down well with religious conservatives. Quite often, though, ironic parallels are lighter, more comic in their outcome, and not so likely to offend. In Eudora Welty's masterful story, Why I Live at the P.O., 1941, the narrator is engaged in a sibling rivalry with her younger sister, who has come home after leaving under suspicious, if not actually disgraceful, circumstances. The narrator, sister, is outraged at having to cook two chickens to feed five people and a small child just because her spoiled sister has come home. What sister can't see, but we can, is that those two fowl are really a fatted calf. It may not be a grand feast by traditional standards, but it is a feast, as called for upon the return of the prodigal son, even if the son turns out to be a daughter. Like the brothers in the parable, sister is irritated and envious that the child who left and ostensibly used up her share of familial goodwill is instantly welcomed, her sins so quickly forgiven. Then there are all those names, those Jacobs and Jonahs and Rebeccas and Josephs and Marys and Stephens, and at least one Hagar. The naming of a character is a serious piece of business in a novel or play. A name has to sound right for a character. Oil Can Harry, Jay Gatsby, Beetle Bailey. But it also has to carry whatever message the writer wants to convey about the character or the story. In Song of Solomon, 1977, Toni Morrison's main family chooses names by allowing the family Bible to fall open, then pointing without looking at the text. Whatever proper noun the finger points to, there's the name. That's how you get a girl child in one generation named Pilate, and one in the next named First Corinthians. Morrison uses this naming practice to identify features of the family and the community. What else can you possibly use? The Atlas? Is there any city or hamlet or river in the world that tells us what we're told by Pilate? In this case, the insight is not into the character so named, for no one could be less like Pontius Pilate than the wise, generous, giving Pilate dead. Rather, her manner of naming tells us a great deal about the society that would lead a man, Pilate's father, to have absolute faith in the efficacy of a book he cannot read, so much so that he is guided by a principle of blind selection. Okay. So, there are a lot of ways the Bible shows up. But isn't that a problem for anyone who isn't exactly a Bible scholar? Well, I'm not. But even I can sometimes recognize a biblical allusion. I use something I think of as the resonance test. If I hear something going on in a text that seems to be beyond the scope of the story's or poem's immediate dimensions, if it resonates outside itself, I start looking for allusions to older and bigger texts. Here's how it works. At the end of James Baldwin's story, Sonny's Blues, 1957, the narrator sends a drink up to the bandstand as a gesture of solidarity and acceptance to his brilliantly talented but wayward brother Sonny, who takes a sip and, as he launches into the next song, sets the drink on the piano where it shimmers like the very cup of trembling. I lived for a good while not knowing where that phrase came from, although to the extent I thought about it, I was pretty sure. The story is so rich and full, the pain and redemption so compelling, the language so wonderful throughout. I didn't need to dwell on the last line for several readings. Still, there was something happening there, a kind of resonance, a sense that there's something meaningful beyond the simple meaning of the words. Peter Frampton says that E major is the great rock chord. All you have to do to set off pandemonium in a concert is to stand on stage alone and strike a big, fat, full E major. Everybody in the arena knows what that chord promises. That sensation happens in reading, too. When I feel that resonance, that fat chord that feels heavy yet sparkles with promise or portent, it almost always means the phrase, or whatever, is borrowed from somewhere else and promises special significance. More often than not, particularly if the borrowing feels different in tone and weight from the rest of the prose, that somewhere is the Bible. Then it's a matter of figuring out where and what it means. It helps that I know that Baldwin was a preacher's son, that his most famous novel is called Go Tell It on the Mountain, 1952. That the story already displays a strong Cain and Abel element when the narrator initially denies his responsibility towards Sonny, so my scriptural hunch was pretty strong. Happily, in the case of Sonny's Blues, the story is so heavily anthologized that it's almost impossible not to find the answer. The phrase comes from Isaiah 51:17. The passage speaks of the cup of the Lord's fury, and the context has to do with sons who have lost their way, who are afflicted, who may yet succumb to desolation and destruction. The ending of the story is therefore made even more provisional and uncertain by the quote from Isaiah. Sonny may make it, or he may not. He may relapse into addiction and trouble with the law. Beyond that, though, there is the broader sense of the residents of Harlem where the story is set, and by extension of Black America, as afflicted, as having drunk from that cup of trembling. There is hope in Baldwin's last paragraph, but it is hope tempered by knowledge of terrible dangers. Is my reading greatly enhanced by this knowledge? Perhaps not greatly. Something subtle happens there, but no thunder and lightning. The meaning doesn't move in the opposite direction or shift radically. If it did, that would be self-defeating, since so many readers would not get the allusion. I think it's more that the ending picks up a little greater weight from the association with Isaiah, a greater impact, pathos even. Oh, I think, it isn't just a 20th century problem, this business of brothers having trouble with each other and of young men stumbling and falling. It's been going on since forever. Most of the great tribulations to which human beings are subject are detailed in Scripture. No jazz, no heroin, no rehab centers maybe, but trouble very much of the kind Sonny has. The troubled spirit that lies behind the outward modern manifestations of heroin and prison. The weariness and resentment and guilt of the brother. His sense of failure at having broken the promise to his dying mother to protect Sonny. The Bible knows all about that too. This depth is what the biblical dimension adds to the story of Sonny and his brother. We no longer see merely the sad and sordid modern story of a jazz musician and his algebra teacher brother. Instead, the story resonates with a richness of distant antecedents, with a power of accumulated myth. The story ceases to be locked in the middle of the 20th century and becomes timeless and archetypal, speaking of the tensions and difficulties that exist always and everywhere between brothers, with all their caring and pain and guilt and pride and love. And that story never grows old. Chapter 8 Hansel D. and Gretel Dumm. By now, I've beaten you severely about the head and shoulders with the notion that all literature grows out of other literature. We're dealing in this case, however, with a pretty loose category, which could include novels, stories, plays, poems, songs, operas, films, television, commercials, and possibly a variety of newer or not yet invented electronic media we haven't even seen. So let's try being a writer for a moment. You want to borrow from some source to add a bit of flesh to the bare bones of your story. Who you gonna call? Actually, Ghostbusters is not a bad answer, in the short run. Will people in 100 years, though, be conversant with film comedy of the 1980s? Maybe not, but they will get it right now. If you want topical resonance, current film or television may work fine, although the frame of reference as well as the staying power may be a little limited. But let's think in terms of slightly more canonical sources. The literary canon, by the way, is a master list of works that everyone pretends doesn't exist, the list, not the works, but that we all know matters in some important way. A great deal of argument goes into what, and more important, who, is in the canon, which is to say, whose work gets studied in college courses. This being America, and not France, there is no academy that actually sets a list of canonical texts. The selection is more de facto. When I was in school, the canon was very white and male. Virginia Woolf, for example, was the only modern British woman writer who made the cut at a lot of schools. Nowadays, she'll likely be joined by Dorothy Richardson, Mina Loy, Stevie Smith, Edith Sitwell, or any number of others. The list of great writers or great works is fairly fluid. But back to the problem of literary borrowing. So among traditional works, from whom should you borrow? Homer? Half of the people who will read that name think of the guy who says, "Don't!" Have you read The Iliad lately? Do they read Homer in Homer, Michigan? Do they care about Troy in Troy, Ohio? In the 18th century, Homer was a sure bet, although you were more likely to read him in translation than in Greek. But not now. Not if you want most of your readers to get the reference. That's not a reason not to cite Homer, by the way, only a caution that not everyone will get the message. Shakespeare, then? After all, he's been the gold standard for allusion for 400 years and still is. On the other hand, there's the highbrow issue. He may turn off some readers who feel you're trying too hard. Plus, his quotes are like eligible persons of the other sex. All the good ones are taken. Maybe something from the 20th century. James Joyce? Definitely a problem. So much complexity. T.S. Eliot? He's all quotes from elsewhere to begin with. One of the problems with the diversification of the canon is that modern writers can't assume a common body of knowledge on the part of their readers. What readers know varies so much more than it once did. So what can the writer use for parallels, analogies, plot structures, references that most of his readers will know? Kitty Lit. Yep. Alice in Wonderland, Treasure Island, the Narnia novels, The Wind in the Willows and The Cat in the Hat, Good Night Moon. We may not know Shylock, but we all know Sam I Am. Fairy tales, too, although only the major ones. Slavic folk tales, those darlings of the Russian formalist critics of the 1920s, don't have a lot of currency in Paducah. But thanks to Disney, they know Snow White from Vladivostok to Valdosta, Sleeping Beauty from Sligo to Salinas. An added bonus here is the lack of ambiguity in fairy tales. While we may not know quite what to think about Hamlet's treatment of Ophelia or the fate of Laertes, we're pretty darn sure what we think about the evil stepmother or Rumpelstiltskin. We kind of like the idea of Prince Charming or the healing power of tears. Of all the fairy tales available to the writer, there's one that has more drawing power than any other, at least in the late 20th century, Hansel and Gretel. Every age has its own favorite stories, but the story of children lost and far from home has a universal appeal, For the age of anxiety, the age when blind faith sang, "Can't find my way home," the age of not just lost boys, but lost generations, H&G has to be the preferred story. And it is. The tale shows up in a variety of ways in a host of stories from the 60s on. Robert Coover has a story called The Gingerbread House, 1969, whose innovation is that the two children aren't called Hansel and Gretel. The story makes use of our knowledge of the original story by employing signs we'll recognize as standing in for the parts we're familiar with. Since we already know the story from the arrival at the gingerbread house till the shove into the oven, Coover doesn't mention it. The witch, for example, as the story progresses, is metonymically transformed into the black rag she wears, as if we're just catching her out of the corner of our eye. Metonymy is the rhetorical device in which a part is made to stand for the whole, as when Washington is used to represent America's position on an issue. We don't see her attack the children directly. Rather, she kills the doves that eat the breadcrumbs. In some ways, this act is even more menacing. It's as if she is erasing the only memory of the children's way home. When, at the end of the tale, the boy and girl arrive at the gingerbread house, we only get a glimpse of the black rags flapping in the breeze. We're made to reevaluate what we know of this story, of the degree to which we take its elements for granted. By stopping the story where the drama normally kicks in, with the children innocently transgressing against the witch's property, Coover forces us to see how our responses, anxiety, trepidation, excitement, are conditioned by our previous encounters with the original fairy tale. See, he suggests, you don't need the story because you have already internalized it so completely. That's one thing writers can do with readerly knowledge of source texts. In this case, fairy tales. They can mess around with the stories and turn them upside down. Angela Carter does that in The Bloody Chamber, 1979, a collection of stories that tear the roof off old sexist fairy tales to create subversive feminist revisions. She upends our expectations about the story of Bluebeard, or Puss in Boots, or Little Red Riding Hood, to make us see the sexism inherent in those stories and, by extension, in the culture that embraced them. But that's not the only way to use old stories. Coover and Carter put the emphasis on the old story itself, while most writers are going to dredge up pieces of the old tale to shore up aspects of their own narratives, without placing the focus on Hansel and Gretel or Rapunzel. Okay, let's assume you're the writer. You have a young couple, maybe not children, and certainly not the children of the woodsman, and definitely not brother and sister. Let's say you have a pair of young lovers, and for whatever reason, they're lost. Maybe their car broke down far from home. Maybe there's no forest, but a city, all public housing high-rises. They've taken a wrong turn, suburban types with a BMW maybe, and they're in a part of town that is wilderness as far as they're concerned. So they're lost, no cell phone, and maybe the only option turns out to be a crack house. What you've got in this hypothetical tale is a fairly dramatic setup that's already fraught with possibility. All perfectly modern, no woodcutter, no breadcrumbs, no gingerbread. So why dredge up some moldy old fairy tale? What can it possibly tell us about this modern situation? Well, what elements do you want to emphasize in your story? What feature of the plight of these young people most resonates for you? It might be the sense of lostness. Children too far from home, in a crisis, not of their own making. Maybe the temptation. One child's gingerbread is another's drugs. Maybe it's having to fend for themselves without their customary support network. Depending on what you want to accomplish, you may choose some prior tale, in our case, H&G, and emphasize what you see as corresponding elements in the two tales. It may be pretty simple, like the guy wishing they had a trail of breadcrumbs because he missed a turn or two back there and doesn't know this part of town, or the woman hoping this doesn't turn out to be the witch's house. Here's the good deal for you as writer. You don't have to use the whole story. Sure, it has X, Y, and B, but not A, C, and Z. So what? We're not trying to recreate the fairy tale here. Rather, we're trying to make use of details or patterns, portions of some prior story, or once you really start thinking like a professor, prior text, since everything is a text, to add depth and texture to your story, to bring out a theme, to lend irony to a statement, to play with readers' deeply ingrained knowledge of fairy tales. So use as much or as little as you want. In fact, you may invoke the whole story simply by a single small reference. Why? Because fairy tales, like Shakespeare, the Bible, mythology, and all other writing and telling, belong to the one big story. And because, since we were old enough to be read to or propped up in front of a television, we've been living on that story and on its fairy variants. Once you've seen Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck in a version of one of the classics, you pretty much own it as part of your consciousness. In fact, it will be hard to read the Grimm Brothers and not think Warner Brothers. Doesn't that work out to be sort of ironic? Absolutely. That's one of the best side effects of borrowing from any prior text. Irony, in various guises, drives a great deal of fiction and poetry, even when the work isn't overtly ironic or when the irony is subtle. Let's face it, these two clandestine lovers are hardly babes in the woods, but maybe they are. Socially out of their depth in this part of town. Morally misguided, perhaps. Lost and in danger. Ironically, their symbols of power, BMW, Rolex watch, money, expensive clothes, don't help them a bit and actually make them more vulnerable. Finding their way and avoiding the witch may be as hard for them as for the two pint-sized venturers of the original, so they don't have to push anyone into an oven or leave a trail of crumbs or break off and eat any of the siding. And they are probably far from innocent. Whenever fairy tales and their simplistic worldview crop up in connection with our complicated and morally ambiguous world, you can almost certainly plan on irony. In the age of existentialism and thereafter, the story of lost children has been all the rage. Coover, Carter, John Barth, Tim O'Brien, Louise Erdrich, Toni Morrison, Thomas Pynchon, on and on and on. But you don't have to use Hansel and Gretel just because it's the flavor of the month, or even of the last half century. Cinderella will always have her uses. Snow White works. Anything, in fact, with an evil queen or stepmother. Rapunzel has her applications. Even the Jay Giles Band mentions her. Something with a Prince Charming? Okay, but tough to live up to the comparisons, so be prepared for irony. I've been talking here as if you're the writer. But you know and I know that we're really readers. So how does this apply? For one thing, it has to do with how you attack a text. When you sit down to read a novel, you want character, story, ideas, the usual business. Then if you're like me, you'll start looking for glimpses of the familiar. Hey, that kind of feels like something I know. Oh wait, that's out of Alice in Wonderland. Now why would she draw a parallel to the Red Queen here? Is that the hole in the ground? Why? Always why? Here's what I think we do. We want strangeness in our stories, but we want familiarity too. We want a new novel to be not quite like anything we've read before. At the same time, we look for it to be sufficiently like other things we've read so that we can use those to make sense of it. If it manages both things at once, strangeness and familiarity, it sets up vibrations, harmonies to go with the melody of the main storyline. And those harmonies are where a sense of depth, solidity, resonance comes from. Those harmonies may come from the Bible, from Shakespeare, from Dante or Milton, but also from humbler, more familiar texts. So next time you go to your local bookstore and carry home a novel, don't forget your Brothers Grimm.